A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's been planning a Japan trip for a while now, and he keeps running into the same speed bump on every checklist. He takes 5 ants daily, and when he asked about travel restrictions, Japan showed up as one of the few countries with a special entry requirement for it. Fair enough. Most countries won't blink at a printed prescription and a doctor's letter, but Japan formally requires a certificate for importing lisdexamfetamine. Daniel did what any reasonable person does now, which is dig through Reddit threads where other travelers have asked the same question. And the pattern across those stories is remarkably consistent. People write to Japanese embassies asking about the form. The embassy says they've never heard of it. People ask airport officials. Nobody knows what they're talking about. Then they arrive in Japan with their medication and nothing happens. No form, no inspection, no problem. The form exists on paper and nowhere else.
Which is the purest possible example of a phantom rule.
Daniel says living in Israel makes this feel very familiar. He once tried to import a wireless doorbell and got told he needed a form that another government office insisted didn't exist. Low value item, so he just gave up. His questions for us are two. First, how does bureaucracy get this bloated in the first place? Is it that some societies just like creating forms, or is something structural going on? Second, what are the consequences, including the ones nobody notices? And what do paths back look like for countries like Israel that realize they built a labyrinth even the people inside it can't navigate?
That's the right question to ask, because the Vyvanse form isn't a travel tip problem, it's a diagnostic.
So today we're asking where phantom forms come from, and what it costs a country to keep them alive.
Let me frame the core puzzle before we dig into mechanisms. The interesting thing about the Vyvanse form isn't that it's useless. It's that the system produced a form it doesn't enforce, and then kept it alive for years after everyone forgot why it existed. That's not a glitch. That's a feature of how regulatory systems grow.
You're drawing a distinction between bureaucracy and bureaucratic bloat.
Right. Bureaucracy itself is just the machinery of rulemaking. Some of it's necessary. You want a process for checking controlled substances at the border. The question is, when the machinery starts serving itself instead of the policy goal? When a form exists so that someone can say a form exists, rather than because it does anything.
And Daniel's question pushes past the obvious frustration. He's not asking how to fill out the form. He's asking what kind of system produces a form that the people who are supposed to administer it have never heard of.
So the arc today is three parts. First, the mechanisms that drive bloat, the rules breed rules dynamic. Second, the costs, including the invisible ones. Third, whether a country like Israel can actually unwind it.
To understand the Vyvanse form, we have to understand how rules multiply in the first place. And the answer is, stranger than people love paperwork.
The first mechanism is what I think of as the rules breed rules dynamic. There's a researcher named Martin Schulz who published work on this back in 1998, looking at how rules accumulate inside organizations. His finding was counterintuitive. Organizations don't add rules purely in response to external problems. Each new rule creates interpretive ambiguity. People read the rule and ask what it means in their specific case. That ambiguity generates demand for further rules to clarify the first one.
So the rule doesn't resolve uncertainty. It manufactures it.
And then the clarifying rule creates its own ambiguities, which require more clarification. It's a generator, not a response. Schulz's point was that rule accumulation looks like a system responding to complexity, but in many cases the rules are creating the complexity they claim to address.
That explains the Vyvanse form's lineage pretty well. Somewhere back in the chain, Japan decided to regulate importation of stimulant medications. That's the original, sensible rule. Then someone asked, what about visitors carrying personal supplies? So they added a carve-out. Then someone asked, how do we know it's really personal supplies? So they added a certificate requirement. Then someone asked, which agency handles the certificate? And by the time that got answered, the original rationale had been buried under four layers of clarification.
And each layer was added by someone who got credit for addressing a concern. That's the second mechanism, the incentive asymmetry. The bureaucrat who proposes a new form is praised for being thorough, for closing a loophole, for protecting the public. The bureaucrat who removes a form takes on all the risk if something goes wrong and gets no credit if nothing happens.
So the rational career move is always to add.
Always. Removing a rule is the only action where success is invisible and failure is catastrophic. If you delete the Vyvanse form and someone later smuggles in methamphetamine disguised as ADHD medication, you're the person who removed the safeguard. If you keep the form and nobody ever uses it, you're not blamed for anything. The form just sits there harmless, consuming nothing visible.
And that's why bloat isn't a story about form-loving bureaucrats. It's a story about rational actors responding to a badly designed incentive structure.
The third mechanism is institutional memory loss. Forms persist because the original rationale leaves with the people who created them. The person at the Japanese embassy who championed the Vyvanse certificate retired years ago. Maybe they moved to a different ministry. The replacement was trained on the existing procedures and never learned why the form existed. But the form stays in the system because removing it requires someone to prove a negative.
Prove that the form isn't preventing something.
Right. You can't prove a negative. You can't demonstrate that the Vyvanse form has never stopped a single dangerous import, because the counterfactual is unknowable. Maybe the form's existence deterred someone. Maybe not. Nobody can say. So the default is to keep it.
The fourth mechanism builds on that. In systems where bureaucrats are punished for errors but not for delays, documentation becomes a shield. The form exists not to be enforced but to create a record that proper procedure was followed.
That explains the embassy behavior Daniel found. The officials haven't heard of the form because nobody actually uses it, but the form is still on the books because it's the CYA layer. If anything ever goes wrong with the Vyvanse import, the ministry can point to the form and say, look, we had a procedure. The fact that nobody knew about the procedure is a separate problem that nobody gets punished for.
Daniel's doorbell story in Israel is the same pattern with two agencies. One office says he needs a form. The other office says the form doesn't exist. Each assumes the other owns the rule. Neither has an incentive to resolve the contradiction, because resolving it means admitting that one of them has been sending citizens on wild goose chases.
And the citizen is the only person in the system who cares about the contradiction. Everyone else can pass the buck indefinitely.
So the answer to Daniel's first question is no. It's not that some societies just love forms. It's structural. Rules generate ambiguity. Ambiguity generates rules. And the incentive structure punishes subtraction.
The thing I keep thinking about is how this maps onto medicine. I spent years in clinical practice, and the same dynamic exists in hospital administration. Every new safety protocol added a form. Every form created ambiguity about when it applied. Every ambiguity generated a clarifying memo. By the time I retired, half the paperwork I filled out existed to document compliance with other paperwork.
That's the paper trail, is self-protection in its purest form. The form isn't for the patient, it's for the lawyer.
And the cost of that gets passed to everyone in the system, which brings us to consequences.
So, if bloat is systemic, what does it actually cost? The obvious answer is time and money, but the real costs are sneakier.
Let's start with the visible ones, because they're worth quantifying. The compliance burden on citizens and businesses is enormous. In the United States, federal regulatory compliance costs are estimated in the hundreds of billions of dollars annually. That's not the cost of the regulations themselves, the policy goals. That's the cost of filling out the forms, hiring the compliance officers, paying the lawyers to interpret the rules.
And that's just the federal level. State and local add more.
Right. And for individuals, it's the hours spent chasing forms that don't exist. Daniel's doorbell story is a perfect microcosm. He spent time calling offices, getting transferred, being told contradictory things. Eventually, he gave up. The doorbell didn't get imported. That's deadweight loss. Nothing was produced, nothing was protected, nothing was achieved. The system just consumed his time and returned nothing.
But the less obvious cost is the one I find more interesting. Trust erosion.
Go on.
When citizens repeatedly encounter rules that even officials don't understand, they conclude the system is arbitrary. That's not a minor side effect. Voluntary compliance depends on people believing that rules are coherent. Most people follow most rules, not because they fear punishment, but because they accept the system as legitimate. Phantom forms teach people that the rules are noise.
And once that lesson is learned, it generalizes. You stop asking which rules matter and start assuming none of them do. That's how you get people ignoring the one regulation that actually does protect them, because they've been trained by 40 dead forms that regulation is theater.
The second order cost is what I'd call regulatory capture of attention. Every phantom form drowns out the real rules. Daniel's case is instructive. He's a diligent traveler. He researched the Vyvanse requirements before flying. He did the right thing. And the system gave him contradictory information. So the next time he encounters a medication regulation, does he bother researching it? Or does he assume it's another phantom form and just show up at the border?
That's the blind spot problem. Bloat doesn't just waste time. It creates a fog where the important signals get lost. The traveler who can't get a straight answer about the one form that matters stops asking about the other regulations they should care about. And then they accidentally violate a real rule because they've learned to ignore all of them.
So the cost isn't just inefficiency, it's the erosion of the entire regulatory system's ability to regulate.
Which brings us to the path back. And this is where Israel gets interesting, because Israel has been actively pursuing regulatory reform for years now. The push to cut red tape and streamline the regulatory environment is real, and it's not framed as deregulation in the ideological sense. It's framed as regulatory hygiene.
That's a useful distinction. The goal isn't no rules, it's rules that the people enforcing them actually understand.
Right. Israel's reform efforts are about auditing which rules actually serve their stated purpose and sunsetting the ones that don't. It's the difference between throwing out the entire medicine cabinet and going through it to find the expired prescriptions.
And the hard part of unwinding is that the same incentive asymmetry that created bloat resists its removal. Removing a rule requires someone to take responsibility for the risk that the rule was preventing something, even if nobody can remember what. The bureaucrat who deletes the Vyvanse form is betting their career on the proposition that the form was useless.
And if they're wrong, they're the villain. If they're right, nobody notices. So the rational choice is to leave the form alone and reform something else.
That's why reform requires changing the incentive structure, not just deleting forms. You need sunset clauses, where rules automatically expire unless someone actively renews them. You need agencies with a mandate to review and retire their own regulations. You need a bias toward the principle that if something hasn't been enforced in a decade, it doesn't exist.
The sunset clause is the key innovation because it flips the default. Instead of rules persisting until someone proves they're useless, rules expire unless someone proves they're still needed. The burden of proof shifts from the reformer to the defender.
And that's a profound change in how bureaucracies think about their own output. Suddenly, every rule has a shelf life. Every form has an expiration date. The question isn't, can we justify removing this, but can we justify keeping it?
There's a beautiful simplicity to that. A rule that hasn't been enforced in 10 years isn't a rule, it's a fossil. And fossils belong in museums, not in the active regulatory code.
What would a saner system actually look like in practice? For Daniel's Vyvanse case, it'd mean that when Japan's controlled substance import rules were last reviewed, someone would have noticed that the certificate requirement had never been used, checked whether the policy goal was being met through other means, and either deleted the requirement or actually implemented it. Either outcome would be better than the current state.
The current state is the worst of both worlds. The form exists, so the system can claim it's regulating. But the form isn't enforced, so the system isn't actually regulating. It's the regulatory equivalent of a scarecrow.
The scarecrow works until someone figures out it's stuffed with straw. Then it stops scaring anyone.
Daniel's situation is low stakes enough to be almost funny. He's not going to get arrested for bringing his prescription medication to Japan. But the same dynamics that created his phantom form are the ones that create phantom building codes, phantom safety regulations, phantom environmental rules, and those have real consequences.
The trust erosion point is the one I want to sit with. Because it's not just about compliance, it's about the social contract. When people learn that the system is arbitrary, they stop treating it as legitimate. And a system that's lost legitimacy can't function, even if its rules are technically still in the books.
That's the deepest cost. Not the hours wasted, not the money spent. The quiet corrosion of the belief that the rules mean something.
That's why Israel's reform push matters beyond Israel. It's a test case for whether a modern state can actually unwind its own bloat, or whether the beneficiaries of bloat are too entrenched.
The form isn't the problem.
Say more. Say more?
The form is the solution to someone's employment problem. That's why it never dies.
You've seen this up close.
Late 90s, I worked for an import-export firm in Haifa. Industrial adhesives. My job for 6 months was chasing a single import license. That was the whole job. One license, 6 months. I'd go to the customs office, fill out the forms, get told I needed a different form, go to a different office, get told the first form was wrong. Round and round.
Did you ever get the license?
Turned out the license had been abolished 3 years before I started, but it was still listed on the official forms as a requirement. So the customs officials kept asking for it, and the importers kept applying for it, and I kept chasing it.
Did your firm know?
I found out. There was a clerk in the licensing office who took pity on me and showed me the repeal notice. 1994. The license didn't exist anymore, but the forms hadn't been updated, so everyone kept filing.
What did you do?
I didn't tell my boss. The job was easy money. I had no other skills to offer, so I kept filing the dead form for another 4 months, and the customs officials kept stamping it, and the shipments kept clearing. Nobody on either side had any reason to admit the whole thing was meaningless.
You weren't a victim of the bloat. You were a beneficiary.
That's what I'm saying. There's a whole private sector industry built around navigating regulations that the regulators themselves don't understand. Form chasers, compliance consultants, people like me, we didn't want the system fixed. We wanted it just broken enough to keep us employed.
And the customs officials?
Same thing. If they admitted the license was dead, they'd have to update the forms, retrain the staff, explain to their supervisors why they'd been stamping a non-existent requirement for 3 years. Easier to keep stamping.
The bloat was actively maintained by the people it employed.
The form isn't a mistake. It's a job. Somebody's job is to know about that form, or to pretend to know, or to file it, or to stamp it. And as long as the form exists, that job exists. You delete the form, you delete the job. Nobody volunteers for that.
That's a hell of a thing to sit on for 20 years.
I'm not proud of it, but I'm not ashamed either. I needed the work. The system needed the form. We had an arrangement.
The Vyvanse form is the same thing on a smaller scale. Somewhere in the Japanese bureaucracy, there's probably a person whose job description includes administering that certificate. They've never done it, but the job exists because the form exists.
The Reddit users who write to embassies and get told nobody's heard of it? They're talking to the wrong person. The person who knows about the form isn't answering public inquiries. They're at a back office somewhere, filing things.
Reform isn't just about deleting forms. It's about dealing with the people whose livelihoods depend on the forms staying alive.
That's the part nobody wants to talk about. You can't just sunset a regulation, you have to sunset a job, and the person in that job will fight you.
Which is why the incentive structure has to change first. You need to make it more rewarding to eliminate dead rules than to preserve them.
Good luck with that. In my experience, the reward for eliminating a dead form is that you get assigned to eliminate other dead forms. It's not a promotion track.
It's the bureaucratic equivalent of being too good at your job.
You become the person who cleans up messes, and nobody gets promoted for cleaning up messes. They get promoted for creating new initiatives.
The path back is harder than just changing the rules. You have to change what success looks like inside the system.
I'll believe it when I see it. Until then, there's always work for form chasers.
Where does that leave Daniel and his Vyvanse?
Honestly, he's probably fine. The form exists on paper, the embassy doesn't know about it, and the airport won't ask. He should carry his prescription and a doctor's letter and not overthink it. The worst case is someone at the border asks about the certificate, and he shows them the Reddit threads.
That's not legal advice, but it's probably accurate.
The deeper point is that Daniel's question was never really about the form. It was about what the form reveals. And what it reveals is that regulatory systems grow in ways that serve the system itself, not the people the system is supposed to serve.
The next time you encounter a rule that nobody seems to understand, don't ask why it exists. Ask who it employs. That's where the answer lives.
Israel's reform push is interesting because it's trying to answer that question honestly. Can a country unwind bloat when bloat has beneficiaries? The sunset clause approach suggests it's possible, but only if the incentive structure changes, not just the forms.
That's an open question. We don't know yet whether Israel will succeed. But the fact that it's trying, that it recognizes the problem as structural rather than personal, is already more than most countries manage.
I think the thing I'll be watching is whether the reform effort survives contact with the form chasers. Because Hilbert's right, the people who benefit from bloat aren't going to give it up quietly.
That's the real test. Not whether you can identify the dead forms, but whether you can overcome the people who need them to stay dead.
Thanks to Hilbert Flumingtop for producing another episode.
This has been My Weird Prompts, the Human AI Collaboration Podcast. If you want to send us a prompt like Daniel did, email us at show@myweirdprompts.com.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.